Amen. We've been looking at themes through the book of Proverbs and picking them through, but just as we did at the very beginning of the book, we're going to slow down again and we're just going to look at some particular chapters as we get near the end. So chapter 30 we're looking at this evening, Agur, the sayings of Agur it's described as. Agur was probably a real name, like it's a real name of a real person, but possibly it's not. It's a kind of poetic device. So possibly it's a word that means to breathe in and to breathe out, to compile, then to breathe out. Sorry, Sam, the screen on the right here is flashing quite a bit, which may not be your problem, but which is just slightly putting me off. So that would be really helpful. Yeah, no, it's solid again now. It was just flashing for some reason, on and off. Now it's perf. Oh, now it's still a little bit flashy. Anyway, if anything goes wrong, we'll have to turn it off entirely. Sorry about those watching at home, but it may be a little techie problem with something which just slowed me down a little bit. So we'll figure it out in the break in just a moment. But it may be worth just... Oh, now you know you're standing in front of it. It's not doing it. Oh, yeah, it's doing it now. It's doing it now. Yeah. So we may need to turn it off or something just so I can preach without it like flashing in front of my eyes. That'd be really cool. Brilliant. Right. Let's look at the guys are moving it. You can tell that it is actually live, and also you can tell that I'm very easily distracted, which is also true. And then we'll figure out as we go along. Right. Proverbs chapter 30, sayings of Agur, and it could be his real name or it could be a poetic device, which means someone who compiles things and then breathes them out. I'm back in the zone now, it's okay. And it seems at first pass, if you look at chapter 30, that it's a random set of sayings which are all good, but you think, well, what kind of holds them all together? Because they seem to be quite different topics. Some are about lying, some are about coveting, some are about adultery, some are about stirring up quarrel and so on, and quite a lot about animals. And you think, well, how does that all fit together? And I think that the kind of motif, the unifying theme across this set of Proverbs is the idea of humility, the idea of humility. And so we're going to look at it under those kind of headings as we go through it now. So first of all, humility before God in verses 1 through to 6. Humility before God. It says, the sayings of Agur, an inspired utterance, this man's utterance, I am weary, God, but I can prevail. What he says in these first six verses pretty much sets the tone for the whole section. So you've got to read the whole section in the light of these first six verses. In a way, it's the kind of a mini version of the whole of the book of Proverbs, where in the book of Proverbs, you've got the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and then you've got all these kind of practical outworking of that in everyday life. Well, you get that in chapter 30. So you've got Agur saying that wisdom comes through knowing God. And he talks about his weariness, and it seems to me, verse 1, that he's talking about the weariness of trying to get to know God or trying to be God, trying to be God of his own life, trying to be in charge of his own life. And his self-assessment, which is fascinating, verse 2, surely I am only a brute, not a man. I do not have human understanding. I have not learned wisdom, verse 3, nor have I attained to knowledge of the Holy One. And then he goes on to talk about the weather a little bit. So he says, who's gone up to heaven and come down? Whose hands have gathered the wind? Very similar to the book of Proverbs in what Job reflects on a little bit earlier in the book, but particularly what God says back to Job about being in control of everything. And he concludes verse 5, every word of God is flawless. He is a shield to those who take refuge. Don't add to his words or he will rebuke you and prove you a liar. So it's almost like in just these six verses, in very summarized form, he goes through a kind of a whole thought journey to say, I'm weary, I'm not God, I haven't attained to the knowledge of God, God is flawless, he's a shield, don't add to his words, don't try and be God. And he has that intriguing end as well, or intriguing bit in the middle, verse 4. What is his name? Who's this God who's gone up to the heavens and so on? What is his name and what is the name of his son? Surely you know. That's very much in the style of Job, isn't it, with those kind of questions. And it talks about God and it talks about the Son of God. Now, again, that could be a sort of poetic device to kind of saying, do you know this person? Do you know the family? But I think he speaks better than he knows of talking about God and God the Son, God the Father and God the Son. So the first thing we see then in this first section is that wisdom comes through knowing God. We kind of learn that through the book of Proverbs, but it's just a great reminder encapsulated in these few words. Wisdom is not about following rules or advice, and it's certainly not about starting with ourselves. It's about knowing God and knowing his word and his rules and his ways and recognizing that his wisdom is what we need for life. And what's really interesting, and it's really worth getting hold of this, without the wisdom of God, we are brute beasts. Without the wisdom of God, we're almost no better than brute beasts. We're just like the animals. If we exclude God, then that's all we can see. And it's really what's happening in our culture in a way at the moment, that we're just seen as animals, grown-up animals perhaps, compared to other animals, but with our own desires and our own needs, and really with no morality. People try to shape and frame a morality around the things we do, but ultimately we are abandoning the idea of morality, the idea of right and wrong. It's all about self-fulfillment. And what is fascinating is when you reflect on it, it's just animal-like. We need to be satisfied without any moral consequences. Our lives are as meaningless, though, as a single-cell amoeba. A single cell doesn't have any less meaning than us because we have no meaning, because there is no God, so we're just brute beasts. And what we need to remember is that in the gospel, in the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ, we don't become humiliated. We don't become just falling at the feet of God as animals. We actually become elevated when we recognize God for who he is, but also recognize ourselves for who we are, made in the image of God. It was fascinating in a recent David Attenborough program that's on Netflix, where he gives his kind of life story and makes a plea for being more environmentally conscious and friendly. And one of the things he talks about is the phenomenal success of the human race. And he talks about how we're different from other animals, particularly in our language and in our ability to sort of conquer the world. He almost has a biblical anthropology, you might call it, a view of what people are. So he has that, but he also has a sense of moral responsibility. Because, you know, beavers building dams are not thinking, I wonder what the environmental damage of building this dam is. I should make an environmental assessment. Dogs. What you learn when you have a dog is that dogs have no control over their appetite in terms of food. They do in terms of water. So you can give them as much water as you like, and they won't overdrink. But if you give them as much food as they want, they will overfeed. Because they're just animals. But humans reflect on consumption and they think about the impact on the environment because we're different. But if we exclude God, there's no reason to be different. There's no explanation for being different and there's no meaning in being different. But with God, there is. And that's a fundamental point. It's going to take longer than the other points, don't panic. But it really underlines everything that we go through, that wisdom comes through knowing God. Okay, second point, humility before God as we view our riches, verses 7 through to 9. 7 through to 9, humility before God as we view our riches. There's a poetic device, definitely, through this chapter, which is about two things, three things, four things. So it's just a way of introducing topics. So here's one of them, two things I ask. Don't allow me to lie, and give me neither poverty nor riches. They're the two things. And then later on, we have threes and fours. And what he asks for is integrity and contentment. And I think there is a link between those two, as we'll see in a moment. But he asks that he wouldn't be a liar, that he'd keep falsehood and lies far from him. And then, give me neither poverty nor riches. He wants to be a man of integrity, but also a man of contentment. You see, we do reflect because we have the wisdom that comes from God, and we don't think consumption is everything. In our heart of hearts, we know that's not right. And Agur asks for neither poverty nor riches, just enough. And he sees that wealth could lead to a sense of self-sufficiency and abandoning God, saying, I don't need God anymore. And poverty could lead to stealing. Now, don't get it wrong. It's just a kind of poetic process that he's making two contrasts. He's not saying, if you're poor, it's okay to steal. He's just trying to make sort of two extremes, that if I become rich, I might abandon God entirely. If I become poor, I might steal. And he's saying both those are wrong. Both those are taking things into our own hands and not being contented and thankful to God. And we know that riches can corrupt us. Have a look over at 1 Timothy chapter 6. Some really well-known and often quoted verses. But they're always worth reflecting on. But godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into the world, we can take nothing out of it. But if we had food and clothing, we would be content with that. Those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a trap and into many foolish and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. Some people, eager for money, have wandered from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. Paul, in writing to Timothy, is making the same point, that if we pursue wealth, we will start to ignore God and become contented and satisfied with ourselves. Discontented, in fact, with our lives, but satisfied in ourselves and with ourselves. And we will pursue those riches more than we pursue God. And it's a great thing for us to pray for. Not particularly that we become middle income earners. That's not really the prayer. The prayer is that we become contented with God. And our desire, our pursuit is not of riches gained through our own good work or gained through stealing, but it's the riches of knowing God. That's the second point. Humility as we view our riches. Third point from this text is humility as we don't think of ourselves too highly. We do not think of ourselves too highly, more highly than we ought. Verses 10, particularly through to 14, although it's hinted a bit also in 17. Agur continues this advice, and he connects slander with integrity, and it kind of links with the section above. Sometimes there is a link with wealth as well, because sometimes we lie in order to gain benefit, in order to gain money. So I think that's why he kind of interweaves the idea of truth and also riches. But here again, he will talk in verse 17, he will talk about the way we use our words here and the way we speak and think about those in authority. Words here to use for slander. And in that culture, a servant was part of the household. So by doing what he says in verse 10, don't slander a servant to their master or they'll curse you. What he's really saying is, don't slander another household. Don't diss another household. Because you're really slandering another family to their face. And he says it comes from a place of arrogance. And he says it starts from a place of no respect at all for authority. You see that? He says, don't slander a servant or they will curse you and pay for it. There are those who curse their fathers and do not bless their mothers, those who are pure in their own eyes and yet are not cleansed of their filth, whose eyes are ever so haughty, whose glances are so disdainful. And Agur really kind of puts those things together and says, slandering, competing against other people starts from a place of a lack of respect and honor for other people, and it's often fostered, grown, in an atmosphere of having no respect within families. It's a very interesting point he makes. Because we know that many habits, many problems can start in the home. And sometimes they can come from the parental environment that we live under, which is cruel or harsh or unreasonable, perhaps even violent and abusive. But also it can come from a parental environment that is lax, that allows complete free expression and self-focus. And what Agar is saying is that the kinds of people who are haughty, proud, and who look down on others and who slander other people's servants, who diss other people's families, those kind of people are people who don't have any respect for any of the authority that God's put in place. And one great example of that is in the family. And we need to make sure as children and as parents, in terms of what we're fostering, what we're seeking to promote in our families, that we promote the idea of respect and good communication in the family, because that will carry over to adult life. If you don't respect and honor your parents, if you curse your fathers and don't bless your mothers, then that will be a habit that you carry on into the rest of your life. If as parents we give good cause for that to happen, then that will be something our children carry on in life. And that will be true. We could widen it out to lots of issues to say, you know, if we have a short temper in our family, if we allow this or that to happen, then those things will carry. If we model certain behaviors, those things will carry from a child, from childhood into adult life. And we need rather, both within the family and in other relationships, to not think of ourselves more highly than we ought to think of ourselves with sober judgment, to recognize other people as people made in the image of God with their own gifts and talents that God has given them. Romans 12, verse 3 says, "For the grace given me, I say to every one of you, do not think of yourself more highly than you ought, but rather think of yourself with sober judgment, in accordance with the faith God has distributed to each of you." Fourth thing is humility in contentment, verses 15 and 16. If we feel that we're really important, then we will feel like people owe us a lot. We feel like we deserve more. If we want more, it's because we think we deserve more. And here are some more poetry coming in. The leech has two daughters, and then there are three things that are never satisfied. Two daughters, it's such a great verse, because it just immediately kind of shouts at you. The leech has two daughters. Give, give, they cry. And it's not really talking about leeches, is it? It's talking about an attitude of give, give, consumerist attitude. And then he says, in a great poetic kind of sweep of all kinds of things, there's four things that are never satisfied. There's the grave. We thought about this morning from the book of Job. The grave is kind of, in a sense, never satisfied. There's always more room for people to die. The barren womb, it never receives a child, so it's always empty and it's always unsatisfied. And land that keeps drinking water, it just keeps drying up. You can never completely flood it. And fire that always keeps burning. So he just picks four things from nature, and he's not trying to give us a lesson about any of those things. He's trying to make the point about rampant consumerism, about a lack of contentment. He's already spoken a bit earlier on about neither poverty nor riches and being able to be content kind of in the middle area here, but he really underlines it here. Because he obviously wants us to not be like the leech with two daughters who cry, give, give. He wants us not to be like the grave or the barren womb or the land that keeps drinking or the fire that keeps burning. Don't be those sort of people, he says. Don't be excessive consumers who want more and more and more because you think you deserve more and more and more. Be satisfied in God. And it's really interesting that because of COVID, because of lockdown, there's been a lot of economic damage. And when you stand back from quite a lot of the economic damage, and that's not to say that it's not really difficult for those involved and who are impacted economically by it, but actually, in terms of that kind of middle area of having sufficient to be fed and clothed and to live our family life. Those things are still continuing, but the hardest hit areas in a way are those areas of luxury, and particularly of excessive living. Now, I don't want us to kind of roll back and to go to some kind of primitive lifestyle, but if you think about it, the whole world economy is based on excess. It's based on luxury. It's based on doing more than we actually need to do. Now, there's a whole load of other things to think about to do with God's goodness and creation and being able to enjoy God's world and the benefits he gives us and all those sort of things. But a lot of industries rely on a kind of disposable consumerist attitude in order for them to be profitable. And during lockdown, some of those things have been closed out. And the call from the book of Proverbs is, don't be unsatisfied, be satisfied in God. And then lastly, from verses 17 right through to the end, it's talking about humility when we look at creation. It starts with a very blunt statement, a bit of a reminder about fathers and mothers. The eye that mocks a father, that scorns an aged mother, will be pecked out by the ravens of the valley, will be eaten by the vultures. I don't think he's trying to say that's literally going to happen to everyone who ever curses their mother or father. I think he's again using a bit of poetry, but I think just to make the point that that is the way of death, that way of disdaining, despising all authority eventually is the way of death. And what he does through this section, although he talks about creation, he interweaves it with talking about making some really blunt statements about wrong behavior. Here about mocking, verse 20 about an adulterous woman who's just a consumer. She eats and wipes her mouth and says, I've done nothing wrong. Here's a consumer with no moral responsibility. And then someone who stirs up trouble, verse 33. It's a proverb we looked at two or three times, I think, already. Churning cream produces butter. Twisting the nose produces blood. Stirring up anger produces strife. So he's saying those are all signs of proud, self-satisfied, self-centered lives. And then he weaves those in with a big view about creation. But it's different to what we've been looking at in the book of Job, and it's different again to what he was talking about earlier on in this chapter. He talks about humble things and proud things in creation. So he starts off verse 18 and 19 about things in creation that we just don't understand, that should humble us because they're just awesome. And he just picks a couple, the way of an eagle in the sky, the way of a snake on a rock, the way of a ship on the high seas, the way of a man with a young woman. And those are all mysteries, aren't they? You know, how romance and how love actually works, that is a mystery about kind of how that starts, you know, what attracts a man to a woman and how that kind of works. And for Agur, at least, there are other things that were mysterious about the whole kind of process of flight. How does that work? You know, they flap their wings, but what's different with a human being? I mean, we know all the science perhaps now, but it's still kind of amazing, the flight of an eagle and what they're doing, and the way a snake can kind of wriggle. It hasn't got any legs, and yet it can move pretty fast on rocks. And then the whole buoyancy thing with ships. And he says that there's just things in creation that are just mysterious to us. So that's one thing, things that cause us to be humble because they make us realize we don't understand anything. And then he talks verses 21 to 23 about things that get turned upside down. So 21 to 23, under three things the earth trembles, under four it cannot bear up, servant who becomes king, a godless fool who gets plenty to eat, a contemptible woman who gets married, and a servant who displaces her mistress. So four areas where things are turned upside down, where the servant becomes the master and so on, a servant who becomes king. And it's a picture of pride. It's a picture of upturning God's order. And then verses 24 through to 28, he talks about humble things, small things that show us wisdom. Four things on earth are small, he says, extremely wise though. Ants, Heraxes, locusts, and lizards. Ants are tiny things, you can squash them with your finger, and yet they have this whole industry of storing up food. Hyraxes are a bit like squirrels, a bit larger than that, a bit like kind of squirrels, voles, minks actually. Minks have been in the news recently, they look a bit like them. And they got really poor temperature regulation, so they need to hide in the rocks. But they're vicious in defending their territory. So they have a kind of wisdom about them. And then locusts. I just read this week that locusts are basically grasshoppers who just got a bit socially active. And so what happens is you get a group of grasshoppers, and when there's too many grasshoppers, they turn themselves into a swarm and sort of metamorphosize a bit. And they organize themselves, and as the writer here says in verse 27, they move like an army. They're very small. They're creatures you can crush. They're creatures that don't have temperature regulation that you could just bosh over the head. And yet, they're showing wisdom in the way that they live their lives. And then finally, lizards, tiny creatures yet brave, come into houses. If you stay in sort of mid to south part of France, there's little geckos everywhere that get into all the houses. And they're lessons about resourcefulness, of course, that we kind of admire. But they particularly help us to think God has planted wisdom in the most humble things, so that humbles us in the end, because we're just humble creatures who don't want to upturn God's order, because it's God who implants the wisdom. And in some ways, we're like them. We're not just animals, as I was saying earlier, but in some ways, we need to recognize that we're creatures who are created by God. And then we have things that are stately, three things that are stately, four that move with stately bearing. And there's a lion, doesn't retreat before anyone. There's a strutting cockerel, there's a he-goat, there's a king secure against revolt. And these are all just examples of proud beasts and proud human beings. And so we need to be humble. Verse 32, if you play the fool and exalt yourself, or if you plan evil, clap your hand over your mouth. So that's really the big burden summed up of what he's been trying to say in this whole chapter. Be humble. See the wisdom that God has given these humble creatures. See that you don't want to be like the proud creatures, like the lion and the king and so forth. Realize that we're humble creatures as part of God's order. And see that when we overturn God's order, it's ugly. And so, don't play the fool. Be humble. Get the wisdom that comes from God by knowing him through his son, Jesus. That's the beginning of wisdom, and that will always keep us humble.